From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, exposing honor killings, we talk with Jordanian journalist Rana Husseini. In Jordan and other Arab countries, women and girls are murdered by members of their own families for real or imagined sexual transgressions. The killers often get away with light prison sentences. Because of Rana Husseini's work, efforts are being made to toughen penalties for honor killings. Recently, Husseini received a human rights award from the Reebok Corporation. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new recordings by the German bass baritone Thomas Kvasthoff. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. House Speaker Newt Gingrich says he plans to convene the full House to debate any articles of impeachment against the president. Gingrich sent a letter to all 435 lawmakers in the House. In it, he tells them they may need to come back into session if, as expected, the House Judiciary Committee approves impeachment articles. Gingrich also says any written report approved by the panel would be available Wednesday. The lead attorney for the Democrats in the House Judiciary Committee has aired parts of President Clinton's grand jury testimony in the Monica Lewinsky investigation. He has also shown portions of Mr. Clinton's taped deposition in the Paula Jones sexual harassment lawsuit, NPR's Corva Coleman reports.
Democratic Minority Counsel Abby Lowell used the president's taped deposition to demonstrate that the Jones attorneys were trying to catch Mr. Clinton lying under oath. Lowell says while the Jones lawyers were questioning the president, they already knew that Mr. Clinton had had an affair with former intern Monica Lewinsky.
To those who would impeach the president and condemn him for not being more forthcoming in that deposition, put yourself in his position on that day. He was being set up by the Paula Jones attorneys and Linda Tripp, who had met with the Office of Independent Counsel just the day before.
Lowell is expected to continue speaking for at least another hour. Later this afternoon, the Republican counsel will deliver his closing statements. Corva Coleman, NPR News, Washington.
Defense Secretary William Cohen warned Iraq today that it is still subject to U.S. attack at any time without warning, and he termed as serious its refusal to allow U.N. inspectors into its ruling party offices. Cohen says the United States will allow the U.N. Special Commission to complete its inspections next week, then decide whether Iraqi President Saddam Hussein is reneging on a promise to cooperate. A Spanish judge seeking the extradition of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet issued his indictment this morning, accusing the general of crimes against humanity. The action follows Britain's decision yesterday to let the extradition process go ahead. Barbara Nash reports from Madrid.
Judge Baltasar Garzon formally indicted General Pinochet for crimes of torture and genocide in a document that runs to nearly 300 pages. He also called for an embargo on the general's bank accounts and assets worldwide to meet possible claims for compensation. Judge Garzon ordered Pinochet's arrest in London in October, saying he was responsible for the death or disappearance of more than 3,000 people during the 1970s and 80s. The indictment presented this morning lists thousands of victims. The step follows the decision yesterday by Britain's Home Secretary Jack Straw, who gave British courts the go-ahead to proceed with Spain's extradition request. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Nash in Madrid.
The government of Nicaragua today filed suit against 11 tobacco manufacturers in U.S. court, seeking to recoup the cost of treating sick smokers. You're listening to National Public Radio News. In NPR's business update, more warnings about earnings are forcing the stock market lower at midday. The latest predictions are hitting both the consumer sector and some big manufacturing companies. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Earnings warnings from some large companies, including drug maker Merck, Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, and Swedish cell phone maker Ericsson, are all conspiring to put downward pressure on Wall Street today. In the case of Merck, stock in the company fell today after Chairman and CEO Ray Gilmartin said the company's 1999 per-share profits will likely come in below expectations. Similar warnings about 3M earnings and the announcement by Ericsson that it may be forced to cut an additional 10,000 jobs on top of the 20,000 the company already plans to axe also sent investors running for cover. On the economic front today, the government announced first-time jobless claims last week rose by 1,000. Stocks in Europe got a brief boost from news the Bank of England has cut its benchmark interest rate 0.5%. The markets quickly turned lower there, though. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The United States said today it will forgive most of the bilateral debt owed by Honduras and Nicaragua to help the two nations recover from the devastation of Hurricane Mitch. At the same time, the World Bank announced an additional $1 billion credit to the two stricken nations. Washington will forgive 67% of Honduran debt and 90% of the debt owed by Nicaragua. Talks between Russia and its creditors suffered a severe setback today as foreign banks said the country risked financial isolation if it forces investors to accept what looks like an unfair debt deal. Russia effectively defaulted on some of its short-term debt when it devalued the ruble in August. Stock prices are lower on Wall Street at this hour. The Dow down 115 points at 88.94. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, offering a world to explore through books and music. Location information, 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. When Rana Hosseini was growing up in Amman, Jordan, she occasionally heard about crimes of honor, stories of women who were murdered by a male relative because of their real or imagined immoral sexual activities, including premarital sex, adultery, or having been the victim of rape, incest, or sexual advances. Back then, the rumors Hosseini heard seemed far removed from her own life. But once she began her job as a crime reporter for the Jordan Times, it was impossible for her to dismiss honor killings lightly. Fewer than 100 murders are reported each year in Jordan, but one-third of them are classified as crimes of honor, and it's suspected that many more killings go unreported. The Jordanian Penal Code has special lenient sentencing guidelines for men convicted of honor killings. Many go free after serving less than 1 year in prison. Rana Hosseini is one of the first journalists to break the taboo and write about honor crimes, which have a centuries-long tradition in Jordan, as well as Egypt, Iraq, Lebanon, Pakistan, and Turkey. She's received international recognition for her work, including the 1994 Med News Journalism Prize and this year's Reebok Human Rights Award. We spoke with her from Paris, where she's attending Amnesty International's first Human Rights Defenders Summit. I asked her how she initially came across the honor crime story.
You know, when I was designated as the crime reporter, I started reporting regular crimes. And then maybe 4 months or 5 months later, I came across this very sad story, which is the story of a 16-year-old schoolgirl who was killed by her older brother because her only fault was that she was raped by her other brother. And I think that was the most horrifying story I came across, because this woman, or this, let's say, schoolgirl, was a victim maybe 5 or 6 times because she was raped, and then her brother threatened to kill her if she told her family, and she had to tell her family because she became pregnant. And he tried to kill her, but she survived, and then she underwent an abortion, and then she was married off to a man maybe 50 years older than her. And then 6 months later, he divorced her. And the day he divorced her, they killed her.
The name of this young girl is Kifaya.
Kifaya, yeah. It means enough in English.
Enough?
Enough, yeah.
That's a sad irony. I'd like you to tell us what happened then as you followed the story. The older brother, I believe, turned himself into the police after he killed her.
Yeah, usually, of course, on the day of the murder, he took her home and he assured her that he's not going to do anything to her, to harm her. And then later on, he brought a knife, tied her up to a chair, gave her water to drink, and asked her to recite from the Holy Quran. And then he slashed her throat. And then he went outside and screamed to everybody that I killed my sister to cleanse my honor. And everybody started ululating and, praising him for what he did. Then he went and turned himself into police. The following day, when I went to investigate the case, by coincidence, I met the uncles who planned, let's say, I call it the execution. And, at first I was asking them that I heard the girl was killed and stuff like that. And they were asking me who told you? And I told them I saw it. It was a small item in the newspaper. And then I started talking to them, you know, trying to see why they killed her. At first, they told me she's a bad girl. Then they said that she was raped by her brother. And then I asked them, you know, why did you kill her? Why did you punish her? Why didn't you punish the brother? And they told me that they killed her because they believed she seduced her brother. And this is really when I felt that really the society tend to blame women for everything.
So this is the answer to the other question, which perhaps might be, why didn't they kill the brother who raped her?
I guess, I don't know, maybe it's easier for them to kill her. I don't know, because they are accusing her of seducing her brother, you know. And I told them, I said, well, there are a lot of men in the streets. Why would she resort to her brother to sleep with? And then they looked at me and they started questioning me. Why do I care? Why am I dressed? I was wearing jeans. Why am I dressed like this? I studied in the States. This means that I'm not, you know, I'm a bad girl. And why I'm not married until now and all that. And then after that, I decided to leave.
What sentence did the brother who murdered Kefaya receive?
Okay, in the penal code, premeditated murder, which is the case of Kefaya, it's punishable by the death penalty. But in his case, it was considered a manslaughter, and he only received 15 years, which of course was immediately dropped to half because the family of both the victims and the suspect dropped charges against their son. So he ended up receiving 7.5 years, while the brother who raped her and attempted to kill her got 13.5 years.
Does Jordanian law define a crime such as this as an honor crime, give it a name, and are there sentencing recommendations?
Yeah, I mean, there are three articles in the Jordanian Penal Code which exempts or reduce the sentence against killers in such crimes. And in his case, they considered it a fit of fury, okay? It's a manslaughter. And he only got 7.5 years. And it just depends. Sometimes they give them, they pass on lenient sentences that could range from 3 months to 6 years to 1 year, depending on the judge, depending on the case. And if it was proven that it was a crime of honor, the killers will only get 3 to 6 months in prison.
This might be determined on a case-to-case basis, but how does the family decide to orchestrate the murder? How do they appoint what male relative, I suppose, will commit it?
I mean, it depends on the family. If they have a male relative who's under 18, they will assign the task for him. Because if he's under 18, he will go to a juvenile center and he will learn a profession. And when he's 18, he will be released without a criminal record. If there's no, of course, they convince the killers that they are heroes and that they're saving the family's reputation and that their sister has tarnished the family's honor and that the only solution for them is to kill her. And they give them financial encouragements, rewards, like if you know, don't worry when you get out, we'll help you get married, we'll give you money, we'll give you a piece of land. In the case of older brothers, usually they select the male relatives who are not married, who do not have any responsibilities, family responsibilities. And if there's only, like, for example, one married man, they will assign, you know, have him, push him to kill his sister. Or it could be a father. I mean, it just depends on the family.
So this is all highly premeditated?
Of course.
What does the Quran say on these matters of adultery, of crimes of dishonor that these women are being penalized for? I mean, is an honor crime based on religious beliefs or is the practice based on cultural ones?
Extremely not. And I'm glad that you raised up the religion issue because most people misinterpret Islam or misinterpret the concept of these killings and relate it to Islam, when in reality it has nothing to do with religion. The Islamic religion, let's say, always calls for forgiveness. And in case of an adultery, God put very strict rules, like there needs to be 4 witnesses to an act of an adultery. So these crimes are strictly against religion. I mean, people do not do them under the pretense of religion. They do them out of culture beliefs, you know.
Well, what is the honor part of the equation then? How does one assess the honor of a family in cultural terms?
I mean, in cases of these women, a woman is responsible, a female, let's say, is responsible for her family's reputation. This is how they see them. If she tarnishes this image, okay, the only way to fix this tarnishing is to kill her, meaning blood cleanses honor. It's like a glass, okay? If it breaks, you can't fix it. And the only way to, in this case, if a woman violates her family's or tarnishes the family's image or honor, is to kill her.
Do honor killings occur in all levels of society, or are there differences from urban areas to non-urban?
You know, from my experience of 5 years reporting, most of the crimes occur in poor and crowded areas and among uneducated people, where, you know, the word of mouth travels quickly and the families see no solution but to kill their daughters to stop the rumors.
How do the families establish the guilt of these women? What are the criteria? Or is suspicion enough?
It could be suspicion. It could be really being involved in a relation or becoming pregnant out of wedlock, just talking to a stranger. It just depends on the family, you know. Sometimes if, you know, I've covered many cases where, you know, women just told their male relatives that they want to be free, they want to do whatever they want, and they would kill them just for that. Of course, there are other reasons that, you know, women are killed where the families claim it's a crime of honor. For example, you have incest. You know, if a woman is raped by a male relative or a male family member, becomes pregnant, for example, they would kill her. And nobody would care to know, you know, if who she became pregnant of, you know, from. Okay, they would say, okay, she's pregnant. This means that she really deserves it, you know. So this is one inheritance. Sometimes women refuse to waive their inheritance rights, so they kill them and pretend it's a crime of honor. It could be just because there are too many women. It could, of course, divorced women are also could be targets because after they're divorced, they're not virgins anymore. And, they can do whatever they want. So you have all these, factors.
You mentioned that in Kafaya's case, her brother had her recite verses from the Quran before he killed her. Is that common? Is there a certain pattern or ritual manner in which these women are murdered?
I mean, I don't know. I can't know all the cases. But in general, you know, in Islam, if you know that, for example, you're going to die, you receive a bullet or whatever, you know you're going to die, there's a certain verse that you say, okay? So he asked her to say this verse because he knew he was going to kill her. It doesn't have to be a murder, you know? You understand?
Yes.
Like you're in a battle, it's especially for fighters. When you're in a battle or, for example, you get injured, you know you're going to die, you say this verse, and it's Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah. You say that if you know you're going to die. It's just this is how we're taught. So in her case, because he knew he was going to kill her, he asked her to, you know, say this verse.
What does the verse mean?
It means I swear that there's only one God. That's it. It's mean like, I swear that there's only one and only God, and that that Muhammad is the prophet of God.
You were really one of the first reporters to write about honor crimes in an Arab nation. How have reporters written about it before, or why hasn't it been exposed before?
These types of crimes are very, you know, the issue is very sensitive. Not everybody would dare to do it, okay? In my case, let's say I was the most consistent reporter, you know. I was the most reporter who documented each crime. Each crime I heard about, I wrote about. Each sentence I heard about, I wrote about, okay? And nobody, I think, I felt that nobody really cared about these women, if they were killed or not. And that's why I took upon, you know, this mission to fight for these women, because nobody cared if they were killed, if they were not, why they were killed, the reasons, all these things. Nobody cares.
You wrote about one case in 1994. A man killed his sister when he discovered a strange man in her apartment. Later, it turned out in the court proceedings that this woman was being threatened by the stranger, that she wasn't engaging in some kind of illicit relationship with him. And you spoke to the brother then and asked him if he regretted what he had done. What did he say?
He said that he regretted that his sister was not, did not, you know, commit an immoral act. But he said, if I were put in the same situation and I didn't know that my sister was innocent, I would kill her.
So honest mistake, sorry, in other words.
I guess so.
Rana Hosseini is the crime reporter for the Jordan Times. We'll continue our conversation after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jordanian journalist Rana Hosseini. She's a crime reporter for the Jordan Times. What options do women have who are likely victims of honor crimes or who are being threatened by their families? If they go to the authorities, for instance, to report a rape, do the police turn them back over to their families?
Okay, there's a procedure for that. And what happens, for example, if a woman is suspected of having a moral relationship and she survives a killing, let's say, she does not die, or a woman becomes pregnant out of wedlock and the authority discovers before the family is able to kill her, they are placed in what is called protective custody, meaning they are detained administratively by the administrator in the district, in any district, and they're placed in prison with other women. You know, they could be criminals, thieves, or whatever. And this is another thing that I've been fighting for, which, you know, I don't think that these women deserve to be there in prison. You know, their life is threatened. Everybody knows that they might be killed, and they're in prison instead of, you know, like having their family relatives in prison, you know.
That's another form of victimization.
Exactly. And, of course, that most of them are held there indefinitely because the police know that if they are released, their families will kill them. So in most cases, of course, the families, once they are in police custody, the families do not want them. And if they know that they are released, they would kill them. In several cases, and I've covered some before I came here to Paris, an unfortunate case which happens a lot. It was a case of a 17-year-old girl who eloped with her lover, and then she decided to turn herself into police, I think, or the police caught them. Her father went and signed the guarantee that he would not harm her. They released her, and he took her and slit her throat. He took her to a forest and killed her, and then went and turned himself in. And this happens all the time. I mean, it happens over and over. And most families, they do not rest until they kill their daughters, you know, who are being held in prisons.
Are there women's shelters then in Jordan? It sounds as if you wouldn't be safe enough.
I mean, now the government is working on building a shelter, you know. Still, this project is in its preliminary stages. But I think eventually we're going to have either a shelter or shelters, I don't know. But they're working on it because finally they realize that this is a problem and that these women do not deserve to be there in prison, wasting their lives, you know.
Just recently, I believe the Jordanian judicial system has been tightening penalties on those who commit crimes against women and children and crimes of honor, in large part, I think, because of the work that you've done. Has the new penal code been finalized and put into effect?
No, not yet. It's going to be a long procedure because, you know, it has to go through parliament. They have to approve it. And, you know, you have 80, all the parliament is men. There are no women in our parliament, unfortunately, this session. But the good news, let's say, is that His Majesty the King is, he's really pushing for, he had asked the previous two governments to work on changing the laws. Her Majesty the Queen is also following up, His Royal Highness. So the royal family, they're all now, are pushing for this, changing the legislation, trying to raise awareness about this issue, pushing for the shelter. So I think things are changing in a positive way, I hope.
In King Hussein's denunciations of violence against women to Parliament and to the people of Jordan, has he openly acknowledged directly that honor crimes exist, that honor killings happen?
He didn't say it this way in his opening speech. He just talked about, that women should and children should be ensured a respective life. I don't remember his exact words, but he didn't, he made a reference to crimes of honor. He didn't say that, yes, we have crimes of honor, He didn't say it this way. He just made reference to it indirectly, but Crown Prince Hassan denounced crimes of honor openly several times.
There are so many threads that contribute to this. I'm thinking that if the judicial system does change, if the penal code does change, and that, as you said, is a long process, there's so many cultural influences and cultural beliefs about the place of women in society. How does one go about changing that?
I mean, that's another problem. That it's going to be a long procedure. But we have to start, and this is my belief, we can't just sit there and say, okay, this, you're talking about changing a whole concept here. And I started something, and I mean, now the responsibility falls on everybody else. It's not only me. And I think that, now the positive things is that the Crown Prince is talking about it, the King is talking about it, everybody's talking about it. Everybody now realizes that there needs to be awareness. People need to know that, we are approaching the 21st century and that these crimes are, these barbaric acts that are being practiced against women are not right, they're against religion. So the role falls on the leaders, the decision makers, the religious leaders, They need to tell people on Friday prayers that this is not right, that this is against religion. The media also needs to play a role, television. And I think they're doing this, but it's a slow procedure, In any like, if you want to change anything in any society, you can't just come at once, because people will resist it. So things, I think things are going on the right direction, but it's going to take time.
Rana Husseini is a crime reporter for the Jordan Times. We'll continue our conversation with her in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, journalist Rana Husseini tells us about walking the crime beat as a woman in Jordan and why she likes to wear jeans and tennis shoes on the job. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new recordings by German-based baritone Thomas Kvasthoff. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new comic Christmas novel by Mark O'Donnell. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Let's return to our conversation with Jordanian journalist Rana Husseini. In covering the crime beat for the Jordan Times, Husseini has become one of the first reporters to expose the practice of honor killings. In Jordan and other Arab countries, women are murdered by their male relatives because of their real or perceived sexual indiscretions. When Rana Husseini was a child in Jordan, these crimes seemed almost unreal to her because of her own upbringing, which was rather untraditional. You were born in Amman. What did your family teach you about the place of women in society, what you would grow up to be?
Okay, let's say my mother always encouraged me. She wanted me to have a good degree and to be good in English because, you know, if you speak good English, if you have two languages, you'll have easier jobs. You can be more productive. So my family really, it consists, of course, of my mother. My father has passed away 7 years ago, and my brother. But they always supported me, and let's say not about women's issues, but just to be dependent, so I can be dependent, you know, when I grow up, to be able to support myself and all that. But let's say becoming an activist, a women activist, I would say this grew with me as I, you know, worked. It's just developed.
You have an older brother. Were you treated as his equal growing up?
Yeah, let's say 95% equal.
You studied in the States. You held some jobs here. You waitressed. You kicked around. And then you went back to Jordan to be a journalist, and you ended up with the crime beat. How did you fall into crime reporting?
I didn't ask for it, but let's say, you know, when I was in the States, I also worked in addition to like holding several jobs at the same time. I also wrote for the school's newspaper, but I wrote about sports mainly. And then the last year I did an internship with the Oklahoma Gazette, which is a weekly, and I wrote about social issues. But when I came back to Jordan, I knew I wanted to work for the Jordan Times, but I didn't know what. So when I went and met my editor, he told me that he wanted me to be the crime reporter. And I said, okay, fine, you know, because I really I always, when I open the newspaper, I like to read about crimes or accidents. So I thought that was an exciting job. There's no routine in it, and every day there's something new. And of course, when you first start, you just take whatever you're assigned to, because this is how you start. And I accepted that, and I just went on with it.
What do you wear going on interviews? I have seen pictures of you. You are a tall woman. You play on your nation's basketball team. you're somewhat imposing, probably don't look like your average Jordanian woman. Do you wear a headscarf when you go to small villages?
No, I mean, this,
skirts?
No. This is not necessary in my country. If you want to wear a scarf, it's an option. Nobody's obliged to wear a scarf, even if you go to small villages. I usually like to wear jeans and shoes, and I've said that before. I wear shoes usually when I go to dangerous places, because as you know, I'm an athlete. Just in case something wrong, you know, happens, I can just take off running.
You mean you wear sneakers?
Sneakers, yeah. Right. Tennis shoes? I don't know. Tennis shoes. Jogging shoes, let's say. and this is how I go to work every day. I mean, this is what I'm comfortable in. I know I'm not the typical average woman. Many people oppose the way I dress, the way I think, but too bad, you know. I don't live for people. I live for myself.
Have you had to use your tennis shoes? Have you been put in a dangerous position when you've
I was, but it wasn't going to an honor crime. It was a regular murder. I mean, I didn't run, but I had to leave the place very quickly.
Why?
There was this father who killed his son with an axe. Okay, and it was in a poor area, so I went and I asked around and I met this woman, and she told me, yeah, she knows all the relatives and the family, and she will take me to their house and tell them that, you know, I'm coming to investigate. So we go there. Of course, I'm an outcast. It's obvious. I'm wearing jeans, blah blah blah, and they're all wearing the traditional dress, and they're all sitting and lamenting the murder. And I sit, you know, and wait. And then somebody noticed that I should, you know, that I'm a stranger. And they call me to a room and they lock the door and they take my notebook and they start, you know, telling me why am I in their house. I didn't tell them I'm a reporter. And I was scared, you know, because they locked me in and they were questioning me and they took my notebook and tore it off, you know. And then they said they're going to call the police. And I said, good, call the police. And, you know, I thought that woman had told them that I was in the house. And then they opened the door and I just left quickly, you know. I was scared.
How do you put the family at some kind of ease or just get them to communicate with you?
Okay, in most cases, even in regular murders, I try not to talk to the family directly. I try to talk to their relatives because I know, like, the first day, the first 2 days, they're very enthusiastic, they're very excited, and there's anxiety, there's, you know, all this tension in the air. So most of the time I try to avoid them, like talking to their relatives, to their neighbors. It just depends on how I feel the situation is, if it's possible to go and talk to them or not. For example, I also covered a story of a 15-year-old girl, a shepherdess, who was killed by her brother. And it's also a sad story because a jealous schoolmate sent a letter to her family, you know, accusing her of having a relationship. And of course, the family, without investigating the letter, the source of the letter or the accuracy, they killed her. So I went and spoke to the mother and I asked her, what do you think of the murder? You know, do you think your daughter deserved to die? She said, what can I say? It's her fate to die, and God forgive the person who sent this letter. So sometimes, you know, you find people who cooperate. Sometimes you don't. It just depends on the crime, the condition, the circumstances.
When you investigate these crimes and talk to the family members of women who have been murdered, are you surprised by what the women say, what the women's understanding of what honor and a woman's role in determining the honor of her family is?
Yeah, you know, I'm surprised. I'm not surprised. I feel sad, you know, and depressed because of the way these women feel or think. But at the same time, I know that I remember the background they come from. Most of these women are uneducated, okay? They are taught up from when they are children to obey their husbands, obey their brothers, to be the sacrifice, you know, to not protest any decision. So I wouldn't be surprised if a woman really helped in her daughter's death, okay, or plotting to kill her daughter, or if they think that, yes, really, my daughter does deserve to die, you know. That's one thing. On the other hand, many women are also helpless. They are financially independent, okay. Most of them, they don't have a degree. They get married very young. They're not experienced. So they don't have a say. If they try to protest, you know, for example, a killing, they will be divorced. They have no place to go. In our society, a divorced woman, it's a big shame. As I said before, she could be, you know, killed later on. If they're divorced, their families usually do not want them back to live with them. So you have all these factors, you know. I mean, as I said, I won't be surprised as much as I would be depressed for their situation, realizing that they're helpless or in a way they're ignorant, you know. And it's not their fault. It's just the way they are brought up to think.
What kind of response do you get from your readers? What kind of mail do you get?
I get, I get a lot of supportive letters to the editor, not about me, but actually they're more upset or enraged by the stories and by the sentences. And most people, you know, they're really upset and they want things to change. On the other hand, I have several occasions I've learned that some people do attack me and accuse me of tarnishing the image of the country, and that by writing this, I'm showing, let's say, the dirty clothes or the dirty things that happens in my country, and people do not realize, or that I'm encouraging adultery, for example. And the thing that people do not realize is that what I'm doing is not to gain reputation or to tarnish my country's image or anything. It's just I know that there are women who are killed unjustly, in an injustice way, let's say, and nobody's doing anything about it. And I think that something needs to be done. And that's why I write about these things, because these women cannot raise their voice. So I'm trying to raise their voice and let people know that these women are killed for no reason and that something needs to be done.
What happens to men if they commit adultery?
Nothing. Why would something happen to them? Okay, let's say, I mean, it was very rare that I covered a story where both the man and the woman were killed. In 95% of the stories, it's women who are killed. The men always gets away with it. I don't know why. The partners, they always get away with it.
Is it because the women are always perceived as the temptress, as the cause, as
yes,
I don't know, the
I
evil influence.
So. And the other reason is that if you kill a man, you will get into a big trouble, okay? Because killing a man, there will be revenge. They might kill somebody from your family, and you have to pay money, you know, to settle for tribal settlement. So, and it's funny, but I introduced this brother who killed his sister. She was, it happened recently. This brother killed his sister. She was raped by one of her family members, and she went to the police for protection. Okay. And the family knew about it, and he told me, okay, I met him in prison, and I met him outside prison. He only got 6 months for killing his sister. And he told me, we did everything to get her out of prison so I can kill her. Okay, so she goes to the police for protection. Then they go and sign a guarantee. It's a routine, like I said before, you know, when they are held for protective custody. They go and sign a guarantee. So his family, everybody went and signed a guarantee that she will not be hurt. They brought her back home, and he was waiting for her, and he killed her, shot and killed her. And I told him, why did you kill her? She was raped. At first, he denied that she was raped. He tried to tell me that she was a bad girl. But knowing from experience that when she goes and turns herself in, this means that she knows that something is wrong. And most probably she was raped. And then he later admitted that she was raped. And I told him, you killed her. Why didn't you try to go after the person who raped her? He said, no, this will be a big hassle, you know. It will involve tribal leaders and all that. So it's not easy for them to kill a man as much as it's easy for them to kill a woman.
Rana Hosseini, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Sure, no problem.
Rana Hosseini reports on crime for the Jordan Times. Coming up, a review of two new recordings by German bass baritone Thomas Kvasthoff. This is Fresh Air. The 39-year-old German bass baritone Thomas Kvasthoff has been making a name for himself in the world of classical music. His personal story may be as moving as anything he sings about. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz heard him for the first time earlier this season, singing with the Boston Symphony, and was very impressed. Here's Lloyd's review of two of Kvasthoff's recent recordings.
The first thing you notice when you see Thomas Kvasthoff is his disability. He was a thalidomide baby, born in 1959. He's barely 4 feet tall, and neither his hands nor arms are fully developed. But once he begins to sing, what he looks like dwindles in significance compared first to the dark, rich timbre of his voice, then to the warmth, intelligence, honesty, and naturalness of his singing. Those were the words I kept overhearing in the corridors and stairwells of Boston Symphony Hall after his Boston Symphony debut last October. Everyone in the audience seemed to sense how effortlessly he connected with both the notes and the words, and his recordings confirm that impression.
Fremd bin ich eingezogen, fremd zieh ich wieder aus. Der Mai war mir gewogen mit manchem Blumenstrauß. Das Mädchen sprach von Liebe, die Mutter gar von ihr. Das Mädchen sprach von Liebe, die Mutter gar von ihr. So trübe, der Weg gehüllt in Schnee. Nun ist die Welt so trübe, der Weg gehüllt in Schnee.
It's revealing that Kvasthoff's recordings concentrate on the composers Mozart, Schubert, and Schumann, who leave singers most exposed. Composers for whom solid technique and vocal beauty are essential, but only as a means to reach something deeper than gorgeous vocal display. Kvasthoff's newest recording is Schubert's devastating song cycle, Winterreise, A Winter Journey. The singer is passing through the village of the woman he still loves, but who has married someone else. Schubert's cycle, though, is less about lost love than about a kind of agonizing existential desolation. The only hope, and it's just a glimmer, lies in the creation of art. In these songs, you can tell almost instantly if a singer is faking, and Kvasthoff isn't faking.
Nun, es wird nicht weit mehr gehen. An dem Wanderstabe, Krähe, lass mich endlich sehen, Treue bis zum Grabe. Krähe, lass mich endlich sehen, Treue bis zum
I'm reluctant to equate Kvasthoff's disability with his capacity for empathy. Few great singers have had to endure anything like what Kvasthoff has gone through, yet they're still great. It's Kvasthoff's imagination, not his disability, that allows him to transform what he suffered into some deep human and artistic understanding. And it's his good luck to have an extraordinary instrument. His Mozart album is a marvelous example of how much he can do. 5 little-known concert arias and 6 famous arias from Mozart's best-loved operas explore a tremendous range of attitude and character. Kvasthoff gives each role a subtly different tone quality, and he's equally convincing in each one. Listen to his ardent, smoothly seductive Don Giovanni serenading his latest opportunity.
Du geile Bocca dolce, più che il mele, tu che il zucchero porti in mezzo al cuore. Non esser gioia mia, onde crudele, lascia tal ben veder mio ben amore.
Now here's the Don's teasing, insinuating sidekick, Leporello, presenting his list of his master's conquests, cataloged by country, age, and body type.
Maramina, il catalogo è questo, delle belle chiamo e padro mio, un cantalo leggete, oh fatio, osservate, leggete con me, osservate, leggete con me. In Italia c'è 140, in Lavagna 231, 100 in Francia, in Turchia 91, mai in Spagna, mai in Spagna son già 1003.
In interviews, Kvasthoff speaks frankly about his limited possibilities for appearances in opera. He's turned down one offer to sing the title role of the hunchback jester in Verdi's Rigoletto, a great role that could turn into a sideshow if not handled sensitively. I'm glad he's not in a rush. A singer with his gift can afford to be selective, and I want him to be around for a long time.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed recordings of Mozart and Schubert by bass baritone Thomas Kvasthoff on RCA Red Seal.
Der Wind spielt drinnen mit den Herzen wie auf dem Dach, nur nicht so laut. Was fragen Sie nach meinen Schmerzen? Ihr Kind ist meine reiche Braut. Der Wind spielt drinnen mit den Herzen wie auf dem Dach, nur nicht so laut. Was fragen Sie nach meinen Schmerzen? Was fragen Sie nach meinen Schmerzen? Ihr Kind ist eine reiche Braut.
Coming up, a new comic Christmas novel. This is Fresh Air.
Book critic Maureen Corrigan has gotten a jump on the holidays by reading Mark O'Donnell's comic novel about Christmas called Let Nothing You Dismay.
When I was little, my family would spend Christmas in Philadelphia with relatives, most of them Irish American. I remember those holidays as smelling of baked ham and whiskey and ringing with the sounds of Gene Autry singing I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus and lots of laughter. But at some point during this annual visit, my dad would always pile a bunch of us into the car and drive out to Valley Forge. There he would launch into his ritual Christmas story about General Washington's soldiers dying in the snow as they waited to row across the Delaware to surprise attack the Hessians on Christmas Eve in 1770. Well, nobody was too sure of the date. By the time my dad was through, we'd all be teary-eyed. Then the whole crowd would pile back into the car and drive home for restoratives. Hot chocolate for the kids, a couple of shots for the adults, and the laughter would resume. Is it only us Irish Americans who, driven by some genetically encoded sense of guilt, feel the need to flagellate ourselves with the Christmas tree tinsel? Maybe not, but as a people, we've certainly perfected the art of mixing melancholy with hilarity during the holidays. Case in point, Mark O'Donnell, whose delightfully comic Christmas novel, Let Nothing You Dismay, scrupulously throws in one tale of woe, woe, woe per every three of its ho, ho, ho's. The main character in Let Nothing You Dismay is Tad Leary, a leprechaunish-looking gay man living in New York. Tad has just been fired from his teaching job at an elite private school. He's about to be kicked out of his sublet, and he's still struggling to finish his folklore dissertation at a place called the Alternative School, whose motto, Tad says, might as well be, "When you don't get into the school you really want to go to." The novel takes place on December 20th, a Sunday, when Tad has been invited to seven different Christmas parties. One of them is a performance art event put on by Tad's friend Norman. After the awful show, an audience member comments, "I enjoyed this more than that one Norman did, where all we saw for an hour was an empty stage while he was talking in the alley outside because it was too personal for us to hear." As snowfall blankets Manhattan, Tad trudges on to a dinner hosted by a successful old college friend, a superior kind of guy who Tad feels reads him like a book, and a book for junior readers at that. But the holiday festivity that most exquisitely combines slapstick with suffering is, of course, the family gathering Tad dutifully attends. The party is held at his brother Les's townhouse. A few months earlier, Les unwittingly lobotomized himself when he put a gun to his head because his business went bankrupt. Les's wife, hoping to put a happy face on a dreadful holiday, has done caricatures of the whole family in gingerbread cookies. Tad's elderly parents are also nestled in, his alcoholic father right beside the booze bottles, accompanied by his characteristically gloomy Irish mother, who Tad reflects, saw life as an antechamber where you wait for the X-ray results. You don't have to be Irish-American or even Christian to enjoy all this alternately merry and miserable holiday mishigas. O'Donnell strikes a silver bell of a comic note here. He's silly without being zany. And in the best tradition of Christmas tales, O'Donnell graces his novel with a happy ending. Like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, who guided Santa's sleigh, Tad, our red-headed, sad-sack hero, finds that Gaydar has finally guided him to someone worth kissing under the mistletoe.
Maureen Corrigan reviewed Let Nothing You Dismay by Mark O'Donnell. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Monique Nazareth. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.